Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Does Illinois' newest cigarette tax help to deter people from smoking? Does New York City's restriction on the size of sugary drinks served by restaurants help curb obesity? Does offering incentives like money or candy to school-aged children motivate them to perform better in class? Incentives, so-called sin taxes. These are examples of ways that authority figures, from parents and teachers and employers to the state itself, seek to exert influence on our behavior. But does such influence actually affect us and lead to change how we act? Today on the program, we will discuss the concept of outside influence and its impact on us economically and socially with two guests. You may recognize the name Fred Gertz. He's the man behind the University of Illinois' monthly Flash Index of Economic Growth. He is also a professor of economics and director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Fred Gertz, welcome to Focus.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also with us is Edward Deasy. He's a professor of psychology in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences in Psychology at the University of Rochester, where he explores what motivates human beings and the nature and development of self-determination. Edward Deasy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. As we begin our conversation, we welcome your thoughts on the concept of how outside influences seek and in some cases may succeed to affect our behavior. Take your own household. Do you offer incentives to your children to behave? Do they have a weekly or a monthly allowance? Do you reward your kids for studying or doing chores? How about your own behavior? Have you ever had more expensive cigarettes lead you to think, oh, maybe it's time to stop smoking? Or maybe would a fast food tax cause you to eat healthier? Do workplace incentives encourage you to work harder or better? Let us know. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Fred Gertz, let me begin with you, and I cited a couple of examples that probably fall into this category. What do we mean when we talk about sin taxes? And I don't mean S-Y-N-T-A-X. I mean S-I-N space T-A-X.
Right. The fancier name that economists often give to this is sumptuary taxes, taxes on things that society somehow deems to be inappropriate. I think it might be useful to break that into two parts. One kind of tax has to do with people behaving in a way that harms other people and trying to make them take into account the harm they're doing to other people. And this goes back to an economist named A.C. Pigou back about 100 years ago. And the argument there is you should tax these kind of behaviors that harm other people to make people take into account the damage they're causing. So taxes on pollution or congestion or maybe even alcohol to reduce drunken driving would be examples of that. There's another category of taxes, though, that are not trying to help the rest of society. They're trying to help the person himself or herself. For example, taxes on soft drinks or taxes on maybe cigarettes, things of that sort. And those are the true sin taxes that we might talk about. And they're assuming that somehow people are not making rational decisions about their own behavior, and the government needs to step in and try to encourage them in one direction or another.
So what are some of the more recent examples here in the state of Illinois that we could point to?
Well, we have taxes on cigarettes. Gambling is taxed. That's kind of an ambiguous situation because the state it's hard to argue the state is trying to discourage gambling given what they do with the lottery. But
right.
They certainly tax it very heavily. There's another reason for sin tax in addition to trying to change people's behavior, and that is if you're not a sinner, you may want to have the people who are engaging in these behaviors, whether it's going to a strip club or smoking or something of that sort, pay the burden of government services, and you who are not partaking in these activities get away free. So you're not trying necessarily to change behavior. You're trying to throw the burden of government services on someone else aside from yourself.
You mentioned strip clubs, and that is a recent one from the last year or so, what was characterized as a skin tax.
Yeah.
We're pun crazy here today. But the idea was that people that go into strip clubs have to pay an additional fee that then helps to fund rape crisis centers.
Right. So again, that probably is more of a moneymaker as opposed to a behavior changer. And again, if you're trying to come up with a new program, there's always some idea about attaching a tax to some certain activity and trying to get people then to pay to fund that activity. So I think the sin tax aspect of the strip club is pretty small. It's more of a way of raising money.
Maybe better examples would be the smoking tax increase in Illinois in the last year. It's an additional dollar a pack now.
Right. But you have to ask yourself, though, would Illinois be as interested in changing people's smoking behavior if they didn't have a financial crisis?
Right.
And I think that the financial crisis is one aspect to making these taxes look more attractive.
And then maybe one example outside of the state of Illinois, New York City in the last year, where its mayor, Mike Bloomberg, established a policy limiting the size of sugary drinks that could be served in New York City restaurants.
Yeah, there are two issues about that. The first is an invasion of personal freedom, which a lot of people feel that does. The other is that there have been a number of studies that suggest that these kind of taxes on certain kinds of food often are counterproductive, that people may actually substitute other things that are even – so if you stop your Coke or Pepsi and then get a orange juice drink, you probably end up having more calories with orange juice than you would with the other. So people actually make changes, and sometimes these changes result in things that are really perverse in terms of making the situation worse rather than better.
And that gets into unintended consequences, and we will get into that. But I want to first bring in Edward Deci. Let's talk about the specific example of the smoking tax in Illinois, cigarettes costing a dollar more per pack. Does something like that work as a disincentive to convince people to quit smoking?
Let me say a few things as preparatory to answer that. We know that you can motivate people with money. There's never been any question about that. If you have enough money and someone else wants or needs money, that someone else is likely to do a lot of things in order to get it, assuming there's enough money relative to what's being asked. There's no question about that. We see it all the time. People go to work to get money. We also see that just the minute the money stops, the behavior stops. People don't go to work any longer when they're not being paid to go to work. That's true with other kinds of behaviors as well. Pay people to stop drinking sodas or to stop smoking or to do whatever, and you might get them to stop smoking or to stop drinking the sodas or whatever it happens to be. But the thing is, just as soon as the rewards or the payments stop, the behavior will stop. There's an interesting thing about the syntax, though, which is that presumably it's going to go on forever. This is not a situation where you're, in this case, they're having to pay in order to keep smoking. So it's they're getting money for stopping smoking. People have tried paying people to stop smoking, and they find that they can get some people to stop smoking when they do it, but when the rewards stop, then it does too. But the cessation stops; they return to smoking.
So, is it ultimately the idea that if the person does not see intrinsic value in the behavioral change, and it doesn't matter what the incentive is from that outside influence?
Well, the outside can get them to change, yes, but the issue is what happens when the incentive stops. And what happens is the behavior stops or the cessation stops. But the syntax is interesting because presumably it's going to continue over the long term. And there is evidence in the past that charging people a lot of extra taxes for cigarettes or whatever it is actually does change the behavior of a significant number of people. So I believe that probably I assume there should be some data available on it, but I assume that there are people who have stopped smoking as a function of the additional dollar tax. But there's another thing to think about here, too, which is ultimately the issue of smoking or not smoking is a matter of personal choice. It's up to people to decide for themselves. And so what's being done is they're having to decide with the pros and cons having been changed because they have to pay the extra dollar. And some will. Some will choose that to stop so they don't have to pay the other dollar. But other people will choose to continue on. And they'll choose to continue because smoking does something for people. It has positive consequences for people. Yes, it's terrible in terms of long-term health consequences, but in the short term, it, for example, helps them manage their anxiety. In order to really get people to change behavior and to persist at it on their own, we need to think about how to help them find other ways to manage their anxiety if they don't have the cigarettes to do that for them. And there's another thing here that I find somewhat troubling, and that is that the people, that smokers are overrepresented amongst the low socioeconomic status people. It's mostly poor people who smoke. I mean, that's a slight overstatement, but there are a lot more poor people who smoke than there are wealthy people who smoke. So what we're doing then is raising money, as Fred said, to some extent, but we're putting the burden on the poor people whose lives may be stressful, and that's part of the reason that they're smoking, for example. And I wonder, is that really an appropriate and moral thing for us to be doing?
So it may not be a question of Fred Gertz taxing the behavior or trying to change the behavior so much as having the consequences be taxing a specific subset of socioeconomic class.
Right. It's basically a byproduct of the if you decide to tax cigarettes, cigarette smoking is more likely at lower income levels. And if you look at it as a percentage of income, it's hugely regressive. So,
right.
President Obama has been saying that lower income people shouldn't be taxed more. And this is a case where you're taxing them a whole lot more. The counter argument is, well, it's for their own good. But so you have these two things that have to be weighed against one another. One is the disproportionate burden on low-income people and potentially some benefits they might receive in terms of changing their behavior.
Yeah, but who has the right to be making somebody else do something that's for their own good?
No, I agree completely. There's a longstanding argument in Alcoholics Anonymous whether people who join the program should stop smoking. And one argument is if you're going to stop drinking, you might as well stop smoking. The other is that smoking makes it easier to stop drinking. So smoking does have some real benefits. Mm-hmm. People are willing to give up years of their life to smoke. That must indicate they get some fairly major benefits from it.
And I want to talk some more about alcohol in just a second, but a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the concept of outside influence and its impact on us economically and socially. My guests are Fred Gertz, professor of economics and director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and Edward D.C., professor in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences and Psychology at the University of Rochester. We welcome your thoughts on the concept of how outside influences seek and in some cases may succeed to affect our behavior. Consider your own household. Do you offer incentives to your children to behave? Do they have maybe an allowance each week or each month? Do you reward your kids for studying or for doing chores? How about your own behavior? Have ever more expensive cigarettes encouraged you to stop smoking? Or would a fast food tax cause you to eat healthier? Do workplace incentives encourage you to work better or harder? Let us know what you think. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus 580. The phone numbers again are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Fred Gertz, let's talk about maybe the most famous attempt by the state to influence behavior, at least within U.S. history in the last century or so, prohibition.
Yeah.
There's an example where the state came to the conclusion, determined we're going to try and change behavior by outlawing
right.
this. alcohol specifically, consumption and sales. It didn't work.
No.
Why did it not work?
Well, it didn't work for a couple of reasons. One is that a substantial number of people did not want to stop their consumption of alcohol, and the government was never able to enforce prohibition in an effective way, and actually gave rise to a gangster culture that exists. Now, there's a modern analogy of that, which is the drug trade now. Obviously, we don't like drugs, but it would be very hard to argue the war on drugs has been successful. So there's some people who suggest that some sort of moderate movement towards legalization of drugs might be good in a sense. It would probably increase the use of drugs, but it might also reduce street crime and a variety of other things. So prohibition was clearly a failure. First of all, it didn't have widespread support, and secondly, it wasn't able to be enforced. There's kind of an interesting thing that economists talk about. It's the bootlegger and Baptist paradox or comparison. Who supports prohibition? Who supported prohibition? Well, one group were religious people who thought drinking was bad.
Mm-hmm.
The other people who wanted prohibition were the bootleggers who were benefiting by operating outside the law. So you had this kind of odd combination of people coming together, the people who were taking advantage of prohibition by being bootleggers and people who wanted to stop drinking, and they came together with a considerable amount of political power.
So we've established that financial incentives or disincentives can serve to impact behavior, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it serves to affect positive behavior.
Well, I think Ed mentioned it, he'll probably want to mention it more, that that sometimes behavior is changed by incentives. For example, some children do better on tests that they take if you promise them M&Ms if they work hard. Other kids who have what people are now calling grit don't have to have that being done. But the question I think that Ed raised was, what happens when you stop giving them M&Ms? Do they go back to their old behavior?
Yeah. DC, what about this idea of what Fred Gertz refers to as grit and what I think a lot of behavioral psychologists might refer to as self-determination or self-motivation?
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly is the case that when you reward people, this is something that's been known for 70 or 80 years, the behaviorists who were champions of rewarding people knew that once the reward stopped, the behavior returned to baseline. In other words, it went back to the same level it had been at before you started rewarding. But what we found actually was worse than that, which is that the behavior went back to a level that was lower than baseline. It's not that you're introducing a reward, and when you take it away, the behavior goes back to where it was. It actually goes back to a lower level. And the way we understand that is in terms of internal motivation, that we have internal motivation for behaviors, and we have external motivation for behaviors. And the behaviorists never thought much about internal motivation. But when you think about internal motivation, what you come to realize is that when external rewards or incentives are brought to bear in situations, it can actually interfere with the internal motivation. It takes people away from thinking about doing something because it's interesting or personally important to them, and gets them thinking that I'm doing this just for the incentives. Once you're doing it just for the incentives, you're losing that internal kind of motivation. And most of the things for which we want to make changes, having students study more for school, for their schoolwork, for instance, or living life in healthier ways by having healthier diets, exercising more, stopping using tobacco. Those are the things we hope for them to carry out over a lifetime. We want lifetime learning from our children, not learning only so long as the M&Ms or the monetary rewards are in effect. And the two things don't go very well together. So one of the real negative consequences of emphasizing and using incentives in this way is not that you can't get people to do the behaviors while the incentives are there, But what we really want is to facilitate and maintain this internal kind of motivation so that people will be motivating themselves to live life in a healthier and more satisfying way.
Let me share an example. We received an email from Susan, and she offers an example of how in her own household she used financial incentives with her kids. Let me just read through this. She says she didn't invent the idea, but when our kids were at home and sibling rivalry was at its height, we adopted the family fine jar. She says it was very useful for kids who didn't mind time out in their rooms and to change behavior when we were out and about. The fine depended on the behavior and the child's available money, and it could be ramped up until the behavior changed. The fine money could then be spent on a family treat. However, we never accumulated enough for a significant treat, partly because behavior changed and partly because our kids didn't have huge allowances. She says, early on, we instituted a weekly allowance of 25 cents when they nagged us repeatedly to ride the mechanical horses that used to be outside some stores. They could either save the 25 cents for something else or have it to ride on the horse once a week. It really stopped nagging behavior. Interestingly, both of our kids grew up to be very responsible with their own money. What's your reaction to
well,
that?
Well, I'm not a child psychologist, but obviously it worked in the short run. The question that Ed's asking and the person who wrote in, I guess, answered was it seemed to work in the longer run. The question is, the children may well have become responsible adults without the incentive. So that's a question we don't know. So I wasn't aware of the fact that behavior not just reverted, but reverted even to a lower level than before. So there's something to consider. There's also, again, if you're a teacher, though, and you're being judged on how well your class is doing, you may have a short-run incentive of passing out the M&Ms.
You're happy to do it, just if that brings up the test scores a little bit, kind of thing.
In fact, that's what's happening in terms of from the time of No Child Left Behind, what we find is there is pressure on schools, there's pressure on districts, and there's pressure on teachers to get enhanced achievement scores. And it's led to a whole range of negative consequences. Amongst them is there's a lot of cheating. I mean, cheating has surfaced. It goes on at the level of school districts in Washington, D.C., for instance, which was thought to be making such great progress. It turned out that most of the progress it was thought to be making was all because the principals and central office were cheating and were actually reporting things that had not actually happened.
Right, so it's not the students cheating; it's the text people giving the tests are actually cheating.
Exactly.
Right. And also, I think everyone knows that there are tremendous, very just like intelligence varies and everything else varies. This internal motivation or grit varies considerably. So, for example, I don't think anyone has to give Michael Jordan M&Ms to play golf well or to play baseball or to play basketball. He has such a tremendous internal drive that, coupled with his natural talents, he was tremendously successful. But there may be other people who don't have that. So it's not like everyone has the same response to these things. Some people don't need it. Other people may respond. But the question is, how do you get them to keep responding?
Exactly. And the answer is that my view of the answer is that the incentives aren't what get people to keep responding unless the incentives go on forever. But what you have to do is be working with people to come to understand the importance of these various kinds of behaviors for their own good and give them, for example, one of the things I liked in the example that was sent in around the bucking bronco piece was that it provided choice to the kids. One of the important things for building internal motivation is giving people some say about what they do, when they do it, how they do it, for example. Anything we can do to facilitate our children's or our employees' sense that they have some control over their own lives, that they have some choice, that they can do what's important for them, what they find interesting. All of that helps in the process of building internal motivation. And we can work with them to facilitate their taking on this kind of motivation through being supportive, through taking their perspective and understanding how they see things. You know, people who are putting in the tax, the extra dollar on the cigarettes, for instance, are they paying any attention to what's going on for the people who are going to end up paying the cost of that? I think the answer is no. But any time we're trying to facilitate behavior change, if we understand where the people are in terms of their own experience, whose behavior we're trying to change, it helps greatly in being able to move forward with them to facilitate meaningful change. What we tend to do with incentives is to run over people without any concern for what, how they see things, what's important to them, and so on.
I want to come back to the notion of choice in a few minutes, but first let's take another call. We have Jeff on the line from Champaign. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had one data point to disprove your speaker's thoughts is that incentives can charge, cause long-term change. My son, when he was young, drove my wife crazy by never unrolling his socks when he threw them in the laundry bin. And we finally gave up trying to talk him into doing that, so she said she'd give him sock money, a penny for every sock that was straightened out and thrown in the laundry. And she did that for a while, and he did, and she stopped payment, and he still did it. So there you go. Mm-hmm. So it worked out.
Yeah. I'm not sure, maybe Ed can comment on this as well. There's another argument for cigarette taxes, and that is that the argument is that cigarettes are at least moderately addicting, and if you can intervene early on, that may have lifetime impact. So if you can keep people from starting smoking between 15 and 20, that may continue on because they're not addicted.
Addiction aside, I imagine also is just a question of habit. Yeah. Once you develop, right. If you've developed a bad habit and somebody gives you an incentive to try and develop a better habit and you actually pursue it over the right. course of that incentive, eventually you do it enough times, it becomes a new habit.
Right. Economists are always looking for perverse kind of things, but economists would not argue that every addiction is bad. Addictions may provide benefits to people, not necessarily the drug addictions, but certain kind of things. So stopping every addiction is not necessarily a goal we might want to have, but certainly cigarettes might be a worthy case. Let me make a slightly different argument here in the case of taxing alcohol. The argument about taxing alcohol does not rely mainly on keeping people from hurting themselves by drinking too much. It is designed to try to stop them from having behavior that hurts the rest of society, in particular drunken driving. So in that case, you might have a stronger case for this external kind of intervention, because you're not necessarily trying to change the way people think or the way they run their lives. They want them to stop this particular kind of behavior, and I think it appears to be somewhat effective in doing that.
I want to give Ed DC a chance to comment on the sock hamper theory.
Well, the first thing I would say is anything that works in one particular instance is just fine with me. You feel good about your son's socks, then great. Give him a penny. When we do research on this, what we're looking at is, in general, how do people behave? So there'll be instances where this is not true, for example, but we also aren't sure. It may be that the son would have stopped doing his socks without the money at a particular age, for instance. So it's fine with me that that the kid got paid for socks, but I don't use it as any real evidence. The evidence argues against it when you take large groups of people into account, and that's the basis for making policy.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guests are Fred Gertz, professor of economics and the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and Edward Deci, professor of psychology at the University of Rochester. And we're discussing how states, schools, employers, parents, authority figures of all shapes and sizes seek to influence behavior through incentives, through taxes, through other measures, and whether those efforts ultimately work. And we are curious what you think. Are you more likely to quit smoking the more expensive cigarettes become, or to eschew fast food if it's taxed? Or are your kids more motivated to do their homework if there are incentives at school or at home to do so? Let us know what you think. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. That's Focus 580. And we'll take more of your calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing the concept of outside influence and its impact on us economically and socially on today's program. My guests are Fred Gertz, professor of economics and director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and Edward Deci, professor in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences and Psychology at the University of Rochester. We welcome your thoughts on the concept of how outside influences seek and in some cases may succeed to affect our behavior. Think about your own household. Do you offer incentives to your kids to behave? Do they have a weekly or monthly allowance? Do you reward your kids for studying or doing chores? How about your own behavior? Are you likely to eat less fast food if there's a fast food tax? Do workplace incentives encourage you to work harder or better? Let us know. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Eileen in Urbana. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. This is very interesting that you have Professor Gertz on, and your topic of rewards is interesting because there are sometimes, I believe, in life that an incentive might be appropriate. However, if you go across campus, the College of Education, you will find very much different opinion about behaviorism. Back in the 60s, there were researchers here named Breiter and Engelman. They produced a curriculum called DISTAR for young children. It's still being used in some places, but there are no better results for the children than mere recitation. I think the important thing that one of your callers said was that's really more important than the short-term pennies for sock rolling, but the long-term and what happens to a person throughout their life if they have internal rewards, if they have satisfaction and pride at their job or at what they learned. That's really what's going to influence behavior. And I wish you would take this topic further and look at the behaviorists and how they're really not very much respected anymore in this country for their educational beliefs.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And we'll give our guests a chance to respond to that. Edward Deci, in particular, I'm also curious if part of the issue is it's not always a question of all or nothing, that we're always motivated to behave a certain way or incentives always or never work. The different things may work at different times in our lives. What do you think about that? Ed, are you there? It looks like we have lost Edward Deci. We'll try and get him back on the line. Well, I'll give Fred Gertz a chance to respond.
Let me respond. One of the issues raised by the caller was the long-term, and that's really the problem, that not only are there differences in grit among people, there are differences in what economists call time preferences. Some people are able to forego present good things in order to have good things in the future. Other people have a very, very short time horizon and don't do things. So an example is why wouldn't everyone the question is, how do you get ahead in life? And the old thing our parents always told us is study hard, go to school, and save your money.
Yeah,
that's pretty simple. But those rewards are not instantaneous. They're 5, 10, 15, 20 years away. Some people can internalize those kind of things and say, no, if I study hard today and go to school and get a good education, and then when I start working, if I save my money when I'm 40 or 50 or 60, I'll be a lot better off. The people who can internalize that are going to do well. The people who are looking for the short-term kind of rewards aren't. And so in addition to changing people's motivation, it's also a question of how do you make people think in the long term, not in the short term. I don't think we have any good answers to that.
And some would say that's an ever tougher challenge in an ever more hedonistic society,
right,
but that's
right.
Maybe another discussion for another
right.
day.
Right.
Let's go next to Dawn in Champaign. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I wanted to comment. you know, when you're dealing with children as opposed to adults, it's a whole different set of circumstances. One of our responsibilities as the adults in children's lives is to help them learn things. And incentive works wonderfully on behaviors that they carry a long time into adulthood if they learn during that process that this is what they need to do to get X result, and are taught the benefit of the result. So to incentivize a child to do a particular thing, a chore or whatever, a particular way, works really well because then that gives them the opportunity to learn to do it. And they will continue to do it. I work with children every day, and it could be a negative incentive or it could be a positive incentive, but it works very well if they know that every time they put their coat on the floor, they're going to lose 5 minutes of their computer time. After a while, they hang their coat up. Now, sometimes it will be situational, because I've seen those that hang them up at after-school program and don't hang them up at home.
Mm-hmm.
But works very well. I mean, I've had children come back years later and say, well, I learned to do this here because I didn't want to miss my computer time, or I didn't want to have to be the person to do extra chores because I didn't do it.
All right.
Well, the children, we're giving them the opportunity to learn behaviors, not even necessarily unlearn negative behavior, but just to learn. You have to do A, B to get at C. And giving them that opportunity is what one of our responsibilities is, and incentives work.
All right. Thanks very much for the comments. Edward Deasy, what about the notion that kids and adults, there may be some similarities, there may be some differences in how they are impacted by outside influences when it comes to their behavior?
We don't find much difference with respect to the incentives and the fact of incentives interfering with internal motivation. It's been shown in kids as young as 3 years old and on through the age range up into adulthood. So we haven't seen any evidence of that being different.
Let's take another call. We have Sue on the line from Urbana. Hi, Sue.
I think this conversation is really interesting, and especially like some of the comments of the last caller, because, you know, if you think about it, so many of the ills in our society are the result of irresponsibility by people. Whether it's, you know, we wouldn't have animal shelters if people weren't so irresponsible with their pets. You know, the people that are irresponsible with their health, whether they smoke, they're overweight, it costs billions of dollars to the healthcare industry, which ultimately gets fed to the taxpayers. So it's very interesting if you can figure out a way to motivate people to behave in more responsible ways, particularly, obviously, as children, so that they carry these behaviors into adulthood. It would be interesting to see, because the cost to society, whether you're talking about prisons or anything else, is very high. Pretty much mostly based on people's irresponsibility. So that's just my comment, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call.
There's one, I agree in most part, but there's one kind of odd anomaly here, and that's in regard to smoking. If you can get people to stop smoking, does that save society a lot of money in terms of healthcare costs? The answer is no. It's good for society. People live longer, they're healthier, they're happier, a whole variety of things, but the sad fact is that everyone eventually dies. Everyone has medical costs, whether it's in their 60s or 70s or 80s. And with medical care costs going up more rapidly than the general price level, having someone not die from lung cancer and die from old age doesn't necessarily save money for society. So the argument is not so much that we save healthier costs, that we make people healthier and maybe have a more full life.
Better concept may apply to other instances,
right,
I imagine.
Yeah.
Right. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions or comments for Fred Gertz and Edward Deasy at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Paul is in Champaign County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. One little aside, which is the sugary drink argument. There's already a food policy, industrial food policy, that makes sugar very, very inexpensive. And so there's, you know, it's not the direct incentive, but there's an incentive to the producers. So I think that at least should be mentioned.
Okay.
The other thing was this idea of the behaviorism and how in poor regard it is in educational circuits. And I hear this constant. The last two callers have, I think in order, have been arguing basically that it works, so let's do it. But the psychologist who studied it seems to say, well, that's, you know, the mechanistic thing is not all we're looking at. We're looking at individual growth. So I'd like for him to comment on the philosophical aspect of it as regards behaviorism, that question he might not have heard if he was already gone. And then just generally this idea that, I think I made the point. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Edward Deasy?
Yeah. If I have a child and am trying to get him or her to do something over the long term, what I'd really like to do is work with that child to have the child come to understand the relevance and importance of this kind of behavior. We can get them to do the behavior. That's not the issue. The issue is for their own personal growth and responsibility that they come to the point of really embracing this as something that has personal meaning for them. That's what internal motivation is about. It's facilitating them to see why this is important for themselves and for the other people they interact with. And if all we're doing is focusing on the behavior and using some kinds of incentive systems to get them to do it, we're not facilitating their understanding and their embracing of the importance of these kinds of behaviors we're talking about. So I come down in the place where, for me, the important thing is for people to come to a place where they're making choices for themselves to stop smoking. When they make that choice for themselves, they're going to persist over time with it. And whatever the other behaviors are that we're talking about, learning, for instance, the idea of paying kids to get achievement test scores, there's no evidence really that that's working. People can give me a particular child where it's said to have worked and so on. But the evidence is really very, very thin of there ever being cases where it's been successful. And the evidence for the negative consequences for it are quite great. So to me, it's a matter of supporting them, providing them with meaningful information that lets them know about its importance for them, and encouraging them to take responsibility for their own behaviors.
Fred, go ahead.
Let me make a clarifying point, because I think behaviorism means different things to different people. It appears to mean something in education. It clearly means something in psychology, but in economics, it has a somewhat different meaning. Behavioral economics really deals with situations where we have anomalies, where people don't appear to be behaving in what people might call a rational way in regard to financial markets and other kind of decision making. So, behaviorism, one of the previous callers was talking about in education, which is, she said, was discredited. It's not necessarily the same thing as saying behavioral economics is discredited.
Let's also go back to this notion of choice.
Well, indeed, if I could just add
Very briefly.
That the behavioral economics are finding some of the very kinds of anomalies that I'm talking about.
Right. So let's talk about choice. Fred, what impact does choice offer economically in convincing people to make changes in behavior that the public may deem worthy of critique? And I'll give you an example. Let's say a fast food restaurant starts offering more healthy options on their menus. Does it work, or do we still fall back on the burgers and fries?
We probably do that, but the argument might be that we need a nudge. Maybe you put the good stuff up high on the menu and the high-calorie stuff lower on the menu. Or if you don't put cigarettes out on the table in your house to get when people walk in where they can smoke. So things like that are things that behavioral economists would talk about. One of the examples in a little bit far afield here is in the area of finance. It used to be when people took a job, they'd be signed up for maybe a retirement program, maybe a defined contribution plan. And the option was maybe put all your money into a money market fund, which few people think is a good idea. People still have the option of changing it, but they often would just leave it where it is. So the argument now, according to some behavioral economists, is to give people what's called a nudge to have the default as a kind of what appears to be a kind of desirable option. You can still change away from that default, but you might as well default into a good thing as opposed to default into something which is not as good.
So a default positive behavior, it could be, you know, you could apply this to the healthcare system and say, oh, maybe the default position is someone has automatically entered into particular healthcare and then can choose to opt out.
Right.
Yeah. So we have just a few minutes left, and I kind of wanted to ask each of you this. The next time the Illinois legislature or a mayor of a town or an employer or a school seeks to affect a behavioral change in the public, in students and employees, whatever the case may be, through a tax or through an incentive, what would you like to tell them about the likely effectiveness of that effort and the long-term impact of that effort?
Well,
Fred Gertz.
What I learned today is that the long-term impact probably is not going to be as great as they would like. And what I would say is that these are very complex kind of things. They're not easily changed. And there's often some perverse kind of outcomes, so you have to be very careful. More broadly, I'd ask myself, do I want the people in the General Assembly and the governor of Illinois making these kind of decisions? They haven't proved themselves to be particularly astute in a variety of other areas, so why should I trust them to make choices about what I eat or how much I exercise or things of that sort? So I'm very skeptical about their, first of all, the kind of technical ability to do it. Secondly, I'm even more skeptical about whether they have the right incentives to choose the right things.
Well, you see, now that raises an interesting question, Edward Deci, which is how you feel about the authority seeking to exert that outside influence and change your behavior can impact whether or not their attempted motivation will work. Right?
Yeah, I'm not too fond of people telling me what I have to do and not what I can't do. And most people I know aren't too fond of that. So the idea of government pushing us around is something that you hear people objecting to all over the place.
But that could be applied, could it not, to any authority figure in any circumstance? I mean,
Absolutely.
We've been talking about teachers in classrooms, parents
sure.
trying to influence their kids' behavior.
Absolutely, and we see it all the time. We see people caught up in struggles with authorities. It's one of the major challenges in life to come to the place, since we start little without being able to do anything for ourselves, and we're facing throughout all of our years of growing up, and then for most of us when we're in work situations of dealing with authorities. And getting ourselves to the place of being settled in relation to authorities is a difficult challenge.
And we've talked about authority and its role in this process, but we also, you know, there are other external factors. There's peer pressure. There's societal norms. All of those things can, I imagine, impact what motivates our behavior.
Sure.
And there's also as we talked about earlier, wanting to do it is not the same as doing it. We talked about prohibition. We talked about drugs. A more recent and more controversial issue is the case of gun control. I'd be very happy to have a substantial reduction in guns brought about by some kind of government action, but it's not clear that the kind of programs that are being talked about now actually are going to accomplish that goal. So wanting to do something is not the same as actually accomplishing that goal. Sometimes it's very complex and very difficult to do that.
And that's probably also an example where until you actually have a collective agreement about what sort of changes in behavior societally people want. I mean, obviously everybody wants to change the behavior of, you know, awful instances of somebody shooting up a school or something like that. But in terms of something like gun control, well, there's great division.
Right. But even if you agree, I'm not opposed to gun control. I'd like to have reduction in the number of guns, but it's not clear to me that the kind of things we're talking about actually would do that. There's going to be a tremendous underground market. There are millions of guns around that aren't going to disappear. So the fact that you want to do it is not the same thing as saying you can do it.
So I guess we're not going to be able to solve all of these public policy issues today, is your point?
Right.
Fred Gertz is a professor of economics at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and the director of that institute at the University of Illinois. He's the man behind the University of Illinois' monthly flash index of economic growth. Fred Gertz, thanks so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you. Good to be here.
And Edward DC is a professor of psychology in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences in Psychology at the University of Rochester, where he explores what motivates human beings and the nature and development of self-determination. Edward DC, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you, Craig. It was a pleasure.
We welcome, as always, any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, is clean coal possible or merely a pipe dream? We'll discuss the concept and research surrounding so-called clean coal with Chris Hamby, a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative journalism organization which has investigated coal safety in recent years. Also, we'll be talking with Evan Tracy, Senior Vice President for Communications with the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. We'll also talk with a researcher who's trying to develop processes for harvesting energy from coal in a more environmentally friendly fashion. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.